From the four corners of Southern California, this is The Hot Seat, and you're in it with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. Today, on the phone, I have His Excellency, Professor Dr. Kanditi Supmankan. Thank you for joining me today, Professor. How are you?
Yes, well, good to talk to you, Max.
Good to have you here. And thank you for being the first person to join me in the hot seat. And we are especially lucky to have you this week out of any other week because today is the United Nations General Assembly.
That's right. It's beginning.
Yes, it is. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that towards the end. And before we start, I just want to explain to everyone that this is The Hot Seat. It's a podcast which airs on both AnnenbergRadio.org and NeonTommy.com, and I interview politicians, government officials, and employees and experts in their field relating to political issues and ask them questions that I think the people would ask them and the questions that I believe the people deserve to know the answers to, or questions that the people have a right to know the answers to but for some reason do not. So now, without further ado, let's get started. The United Nations report on the use of chemical weapons in Syria was released last Monday. The report confirmed that nerve gas was used in Syria on August 21, 2013, but failed to say which party used them, even though there is strong evidence to show that the Syrian regime did so. Do the results of this report surprise you in any way?
No, in fact, I was expecting that. It was very clear that chemical weapons, especially sarin, were used. Mm-hmm. And so what was missing was actually the smoking gun, and it's still not completely there, the smoking gun. Although if you ask me what I think there is a strong possibility, very strong possibility, looking at all the elements that we have, that the Syrian government was involved. But again, you know, the Russians have a different view. And the Syrian government itself is blaming the rebels for doing this. So again, we have strong evidence. I think we have a strong possibility that the Syrians were involved, but not confirmed 100%.
And it's interesting you bring up Russia, because I think it was the other day that Russia said if Putin or if Assad doesn't cooperate, then Russia will stop supporting them. But is there any doubt in your mind that Assad did this?
Like I said, I think from the evidence that we have seen, I would say that it's over 90% possibility that it was done by the Assad regime. But we still don't have that smoking gun, which would confirm it.
Now, do you think that smoking gun exists?
Possibly, but again, you know, we do have arguments on both sides. I mean, from our point of view here, it seems that with the capabilities that are asymmetrical, you know, the Assad regime has much more capability to have, you know, such weapons, and as well as to deliver such weapons. You have that situation. But the other side would argue that, well, you know, it was the rebel that actually did that in order to discredit the government. So, you know, that's the debate that I think your listeners will have to come to their own conclusion.
Yes, that is very true. And we'll get further into this topic a little bit more. But I want to go back to what you wrote, the column you wrote in the Bangkok Post on September 10th. Column, you implied that a diplomatic solution to the problem would be very difficult to achieve. However, we can say that Secretary Kerry and Minister Lavrov of Russia proved you and most other people wrong. So what are your thoughts on the agreement that was reached?
Well, actually, in my article that you have cited, I did not actually say that. What I was referring to was the fact that humanitarian intervention seems very difficult for the international community, especially,
yeah,
you know, because you have 100,000 people reported killed before the accusation of chemical weapons that we're talking about now. And so, you know, that's a subject in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the agreement is concerned, you know, it's an interesting part of diplomacy. We have an agreement, but we have different interpretations of such agreement.
Yeah.
So the Russians are interpreting from one angle, And, of course, the U.S. is interpreting a different version. So you have that to work on.
Mm-hmm. And you have experience in this field, being the former foreign minister of the Kingdom of Thailand, the 39th foreign minister of the Kingdom of Thailand. So what you know that these agreements take enforcement, but the media has brought up the fact that there is no real way to enforce this unless Syria goes through with its commitment to sign the ban on chemical weapons. Would you agree with the idea that there is real no enforcement of this agreement?
Well, a bit more complicated here. First of all, the Syrians have just signed, joined into the, as far as the ban on chemical weapons are concerned, just a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So they're on board, and now since they have signed up for that, they are actually under the jurisdiction of the OPCW, which is the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And this organization will actually do the verification. And I believe that the Russians have suggested that they might participate in verification also.
Mm-hmm. And what happens if, now that Syria is part of, has signed the pact, what happens if Syria doesn't comply?
If they fail to comply, then that would actually legitimize international reaction against Syria more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, be careful about this, though, because for firm international action to take place or reaction, that should come from the UN Security Council. And the Russians have already been vetoing any draft resolutions which would imply the use of force against the Syrian government.
Mm-hmm.
So there are more obstacles to tackle.
Yeah, so that's the next question I was going to ask you, is that if for some reason Syria doesn't comply with the pact that they signed, the enforcement mechanism must be through the UN Security Council.
For the international enforcement, yes. If the organization, the OPCW, comes out explicitly saying that there's non-compliance,
mm-hmm.
Then it would probably go back to the Security Council. In other words, the use of force has to come under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which means that the Security Council would have to authorize or order the use of force, and that would be subjected to Russian veto, potentially.
Russian and Chinese. We know that the Chinese has been against in UN action for various reasons in the past with other countries. But it doesn't mean...
Yes, you're right on that point. The Chinese have been consistently against... Well, they did not veto the situation in Libya, if you would recall.
Yeah.
But the Chinese have been sensitive about UN intervention or international intervention, looking at their own situation at home.
And being a foreign minister, you know what it's like working with the UN. Do you believe that what they do is, or do you believe that they really do anything productive for the international community? Because the U.S. could single-handedly go and do something in Syria if the UN Security Council decides not to pursue force.
Yes, the UN actually served as an organization that legitimizes or makes certain acts illegitimate. In other words, the international community looks at UN decisions. Look at the situation in Iraq when the U.S. went in without UN authority
mm-hmm.
or authorization. Then you had a situation in which many people felt that the U.S. intervention in Iraq was illegal. So the U.N. plays a major role on this, and it's also the moral authority of the world.
Yeah, but the U.S. sees itself in some cases as the world's police. So, like I said, they could not go along with the U.N., or if the U.N. decides not to go along with the U.S. could always go in on their own.
Yes, the U.S. could do that, but at substantial political and moral costs. And you probably saw that in Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
There was a major cost to that.
And while we're on the subject of President Obama, I want to ask two more questions, and then we'll continue on with with more with Syria. What is your impression of President Obama on the world stage, given the way he's handled this thus far? Do you think it's damaged his image?
Well, I think it's a very delicate issue and difficult for him because, you know, he came out drawing the red line. And once you draw a red line and someone crosses and you don't react, then your credibility is on the line. So, you know, when I teach international diplomacy, I always tell my students, be careful about red lines. And sometimes it's prudent to be vague, gives you more room to maneuver. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a lesson.
Absolutely. And you went back to Thailand over the summer. And
yes.
As I mentioned, you are a UCLA professor, and I want to thank you for joining us during the first week of class.
My pleasure.
When you went back to Thailand, what was the perception of President Obama there? And did the Thai government believe that he is no longer legitimate on the international stage?
Oh, no, not at all. We in Thailand, President Obama is seen as a good friend. The U.S. is seen as a very, very good friend. We have celebrated actually 180 years of happy relations between Thailand and the U.S. So it's a very, very healthy relationship. So he is seen as a good friend and ally.
Okay, that's very good to know. And that's a perspective that our viewers probably will not have. And continuing on, you have, as I've mentioned before, you have the unique ability to have some idea of what John Kerry is going through and what he went through during negotiations. What do you believe, from your expertise, were some of the issues that were discussed at the Geneva during the negotiations in Geneva?
Yes, well, Geneva was... Hello?
Yes.
Okay, we're still on, right?
Yes.
Yes, Geneva was very difficult negotiations because, as you know, the Russians came from a very different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And the task was to merge. And I think after hours of negotiations, they were able to merge to a good degree. You know, an agreement came out, but as I mentioned earlier, often in diplomacy, you have an agreement, but you have different interpretations of the agreement. And mm-hmm. this is the thing that both sides will have to struggle with, to try to align the different interpretations.
Okay. And what do you think Secretary Kerry is thinking now, now that they've reached those negotiations? And what is the strain and stress on the body that he must be feeling as a result of all this?
Well, I would imagine that he should be pleased that we are now addressing at least one major aspect of the problem, and that is the use of chemical weapons. And the Syrians have actually presented what was called on them to do so within the first week, and they have actually presented with the lists of chemical weapons. And so now that aspect is seen as a success,
mm-hmm.
and now we have to go on and continue with the actual disarming the chemical weapons, the destruction of chemical weapons, and all those other steps that need to be taken.
And you bring that up, and that's a very good point, that it's going to be, I personally think, it's going to be difficult to do all of that while they're in the middle of a civil war.
It is very difficult, and it will take a substantial amount of time, and it will take objective observers to be able to help verify the job. And so the UN involvement is crucial, and I'm sure that individual countries will probably try to participate in the verification process.
Yes, and Russia was one of the first to do that and tell Syria that they'd be able to take the chemical weapons. Did that make you suspicious at all that Russia was offering to take all their chemical weapons?
Well, I think it's a diplomatic game.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. will have to be careful about what's going on. You know, you have things between the lines to read. And so you have that major framework agreement now. But yes, you have to be up to the game, and you have to really understand what might be going on behind certain situations. So be careful, be prudent, but we have moved ahead to a degree. So we have to continue to move ahead.
That is very true. But at the same time, it's Russia's the one who's leading this. And do you believe that the international community still sees Russia, that still believes that Russia has good intentions?
I think in diplomacy, you have to look a bit deeper. Mm-hmm. Don't assume just good intentions, but look at the deeds. So I think the international community will look at the steps that will be taken, especially the steps that Russia will take. So that continues to be seen.
And in Thailand, as I mentioned, you were there over the summer. How is Putin viewed?
Well, our relationship with Russia has been good also, but mm-hmm. we've had some issues. We've had issues about extradition of Russian nationals to the U.S., in fact, the weapons dealer, you probably recall. Mm-hmm. And so it's a delicate relationship. It's not as strong a relationship as Thailand's relationship with the U.S.
But the two countries do have formal diplomatic relations.
Oh, yes. Yes, we have formal diplomatic relations. We have, and that's been going on for a long time. But the closeness of the relationship, I would say, Thailand is much closer to the U.S.
Okay, and you mentioned the extradition of, or the lack of U.S. nationals, and that brings up to what they're doing with Edward Snowden. Do you believe that, and this is, I mean, on TV I heard that because of what they're doing with holding Snowden, that put them on the world stage, and what they're doing with leading the Syria negotiations, that has elevated them back to a world power. Do you believe that Russia is now a major world power again?
Well, Russia has always been a world power, although since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, it has been seen as less able than the Soviet days. And of course, it was sidelined on many issues. Mm-hmm. But the as far as looking at it as a major power, it continues to be with the military equation, the economic equation. However, in recent days, with their role now, especially with the chemical weapons issues in Syria, the Russians do see themselves as very successful in being able to put this on the agenda. But, you know, as you will probably recall, Secretary Kerry was the one who kind of referred to the possibility of this way out as a potential solution. In other words, if the Syrians were to give up chemical weapons, then maybe there would be no attack. So that was hinted by Kerry, mm-hmm. But then that was picked up by the Russians and used to the maximum.
Yeah, that was a rhetorical question and a very ironic one at that. Go ahead.
No, but this is why diplomacy is a lot of fun, because it is an art, and it depends on the ability of the players to pick up things, to create and be imaginative and create solutions. So we are seeing that.
I would agree with that completely as an outside observer and as a journalist. Referring back to Secretary Kerry's comments, from those comments and from President Obama's hesitancy, would you say that the U.S. doesn't really want to go to war with Syria or go about doing airstrikes?
Yes, I would imagine that the red line that was presented by President Obama probably made him feel uncomfortable himself, especially when the British backed down. You probably recall that. And so it was a bit difficult. And not being able to get UN authorization, he decided eventually to postpone the situation and place another step in this equation, and that was to go to Congress.
Yes, and as one of my professors said, he was in a corner and he dragged Congress in a corner with him. But you bring up very good points, and it will be very interesting to see what happens now. And one of the ironic occurrences was that Obama kept saying that he'd go into Syria without his allies, but he seemed a little bit more hesitant when he asked the allies, and they all said no. So,
yes, I think all of us would have been, to go in alone again, even with the French. And the French clearly said that they would support and join in, but mm-hmm. they would not do so alone, and they would be the minor partner, so to speak.
Yeah.
So yes, it was a high risk game,
and I'm sure
especially in light of what happened in Iraq and what happened in Afghanistan, you will recall all that.
Absolutely, I was just going to say it's probably the residual feeling of Iraq that's putting all this extra feeling on it for the American people and for our president.
Yes, and also without UN authorization, just like Iraq. So you have that to contend with.
That's very true. And I want to stay in the Middle East, and one or two more questions because I know you have to go. I want to talk about Israel for a moment. This is all in Israel's backyard, and we know that Israel has a legitimate fear of Syria's chemical weapons, and especially if they could go into Iran, which has said they want to take Israel off the map, although that may be changing with the new president. We'll wait and see what happens at the UN in the next few days. But do you believe that Israel is worried, and do you believe that part of this is to stall for Israel to do something?
Israel has been concerned, definitely. But as far as Israel's decision to act, I think that there is no real consensus in Israel. In fact, the military in Israel probably feels that it may not be wise to have a military strike against Iran. This is probably the Iranian nuclear equation. The situation is that an attack on a Hartan base in Iran that would have the nuclear weapons contained in. It's a very difficult situation. You need very accurate weapons, and those weapons are available in the U.S., mm-hmm. But not so much. The capabilities in Israel is less, so the chances of complete victory is not certain. So there is a high degree of risk, and therefore lack of consensus on that.
Would you agree with the statement that Iran could obtain the chemical weapons and attack Israel?
I would probably doubt that the Iranians would feel it in their interest to do any of that at this point.
Okay. And I want to bring up, like I mentioned, their new president. This could be a changing tide with diplomatic relations between Iran and the rest of the world. Would you agree?
Yes. It's another window of opportunity, definitely.
And there's a possibility that President Obama could be meeting with the Iranian president, so we'll wait to see on that. And one more question.
Yes, but also be mindful that even if President Obama does not actually meet with the new president of Iran, U.S. officials may be meeting with Iranian officials. And so, those are the things to look at.
That's very true, and those still count as official meetings between the two countries?
Yes.
And one more question about President Obama, or one more question about the issue at hand, is that he will be going to Asia for various meetings in October, including the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation in Indonesia and the East Asia Summit. What do you think about the president traveling to that long distance to meet with Asian leaders? What do you think it says?
I think it's a good message, and it's a continuation of the good message that President Obama initiated when he came into office. In the past, countries in Southeast Asia and many countries in the Asia-Pacific region felt that the U.S. was focusing too much exclusive attention on Iraq and the Middle East. And so it, as a world power, it is good to think of Southeast Asia. The U.S. has so many friends in Southeast Asia. I mean, Thailand is one. It's a very healthy signal that Obama is very engaged in the Asia-Pacific region.
And what do you think it says about the region? Are they on the? Is the region on the economic upswing?
Yes. Well, it's definitely a very, very important region economically. It has the very, very strong potential for growth. People think of it as the engine for growth. And that is the Asia Pacific region. So, it's a region of potentials for the U.S. to have mutual gains, as well as a region that the U.S. will have to look at, especially in light of the ongoing U.S.-China relationship.
Yes, and as we know, that's very fragile, but yet it's a very important relationship for the U.S. to have economically. And one more thing, and I promise this is the last time I'm going to say this, what are the highlights you're expecting out of the U.N. General Assembly in the next few days?
Oh, I think that you will hear speeches, and that would be something very similar to the years gone by. You know, many different leaders will be presenting their speeches. But what may become even more important would be the sideshows. In other words, when leaders get to the UN, they have separate bilateral meetings with other leaders. And so those are the things that may or may not be publicized, but I expect that we'll see a lot of fruits from the bilateral meetings alongside the UN formal General Assembly.
That's a very good point, because the speeches are all rhetoric, one could argue, whereas the bilateral meetings are actually action.
Yes, and negotiations going on. And also, not only formal bilateral meetings, but you have corridor meetings, negotiations going on in different restaurants. You have working lunches, working dinners, and now many working breakfasts. And I remember my own participation in all of them.
That's great. And you have the unique experience of being at the UN for all of this. Thank you very much for joining me today in the hot seat, Dr. Sukhmon Khan. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to come in and join me today.
My pleasure, Max.
Thank you. The Hot Seat After Hours, where you can talk to me in between episodes, starts right now. You can email me at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can also read and follow my blog, maxschwartztv.blogspot.com. Feel free to send me your questions, comments, or concerns, any questions you want me to ask the guests, or feel free if you ever want to reach out just to talk politics or something that was covered on the show. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you will join me next time. Have a good rest of the week.